becomes stronger, it becomes more cemented. To such an extent, as the Imam continues, that the whiteness increases, all right, with the magnitude. So whenever faith increases in magnitude, the whiteness increases. So the white spot obviously grows. Again, it is a similitude here. A simile. So when faith is completed, the entire heart becomes white. Again, what is meant here by white is that it becomes pure, it becomes nur, it becomes light. Again, one of the means we said how this could occur is via our own actions and our good deeds. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to complete our faith in this world, for the only way we could actually see that whiteness, whether or not it was true or not, is in the hereafter. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Spotlight. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli violations of occupied Palestinian territories is a phenomenon that occurs almost daily, but the violations have been so incessant that it looks like the world has become numb to it. In the latest aggression, Israeli forces fatally shot a Palestinian man at a checkpoint. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Israel continues to get away with it, and whether the U.S. support for Israeli aggression is a reason for Israel's continued violation of international law and the crimes that it is committing.
Palestinians and rights group condemned Jerusalem execution. OHCHR shocked by Israel's killing of Palestinian man in Jerusalem. Israeli forces raid house of Palestinian man shot dead over alleged attack. Israeli forces attack Palestinian farmers and fishermen in besieged Gaza. These are some of the headlines in the past few days that show not a day goes by in the occupied territories without the Israeli regime's atrocities against Palestinians amid a deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies. In the latest aggression, Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian man point-blank at a checkpoint near the occupied West Bank city of Tulkarm. The regime claims the Palestinian was gunned down after he rammed a vehicle into an Israeli guard. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas, have hailed the attack against occupying forces. They say it represents the natural reaction of the Palestinian nation against Israeli crimes and the ongoing occupation. The fatal shooting was the second such incident in the past week. On Saturday, the Israeli forces killed a young Palestinian man in occupied Al-Quds, claiming he had tried to stab an officer after wounding a man. Israel often uses stabbing as a pretext to kill Palestinians at close range. The footage of the cold-blooded killing, which showed Israeli forces shooting the man at least twice while he was already lying on the ground, triggered widespread condemnation from Palestinian officials, the UN and rights groups. The UN Human Rights Office said it was shocked by the incident.
Extrajudicial killings such as this are the consequences of the regular resort to lethal force by well-armed and well-protected Israeli military personnel against Palestinians, and the almost total lack of accountability for killings and injuries of Palestinians by Israeli forces.
Not even Palestinian children and teenagers are immune to Israeli brutality. Last month, the regime forces killed 14-year-old Amjad Abu Sultan in the West Bank city of Bethlehem. His body was seized by the regime and was not released to his family until days later. Israeli troops have on numerous occasions been caught on camera for the brutal killing of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, with the videos going viral and sparking international condemnation. However, the international community's inaction has emboldened the regime to press ahead with its extensive use of lethal force against Palestinians. Israel's atrocities are not limited to brutal killings of Palestinians. A UN report last month revealed that the number of Palestinian structures confiscated or demolished in the occupied territories has increased by 21% in 2021 compared to last year. Palestinians say the move is part of the regime's land grab policy aimed at paving the way for its settlement expansion. Israel has sped up its settlements construction in the occupied territories despite international condemnation. Last month, the regime approved thousands more settler units near Al-Quds in defiance of international law. Israel's policies have not only exposed the UN, but also the countries self-proclaiming as human rights defenders. On top sits the United States, that has voted some 50 UN Security Council resolutions critical of Israel in the past four decades, and actually gives a green light to the regime to fulfill its occupation agenda and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Palestinian journalist, writer, and activist Khaled Barkat, who joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, Palestinian scientist and author Mazin Kumsaya, who joins us from Bethlehem.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Khaled Barkat. It's going to be a little bit lengthy, but I have to highlight it. It comes from a source by the name of PCHR, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. You may have heard of it. Comes out with weekly reports of what happens in the occupied territories. Week after week, these reports come out. This is this week, 25th of November to 1st of December. I'm going to give the short version because it would take too much time. Excessive use of force, 11 Palestinians shot and wounded, including six children, seven Palestinian fishermen arrested, two fishing boats confiscated, Israeli forces shooting reported against five fishing boats, 156 Israeli forces incursions, including in the occupied East Jerusalem, 80 civilians to have been injured. You have demolitions that have happened, two homes self-demolished, another demolished by the Israeli forces, and another order placed for 58 homes. It was denied. And then you have settlements, Israel announcing plans to build 2,000. One week, every week, you have similar type reports. So when you see this, what do you think? Because many parts of the world don't realize that this is happening on such a scale on a weekly basis.
Yes, these are Israeli crimes and atrocities that is covering in your report the West Bank and Gaza and what people, Palestinian people, have been facing, you know, on a daily basis. There is an international complicity here, and the United States is absolutely complicit in these crimes, because what they do is not just that they support Israel, but they also provide protection for Israel on an international scene. Let's remember that most of these killings are targeting Palestinian children and youth between the age of 14 and 23. And many times the Israeli crimes against people in Gaza go unseen, and also not to count what Israel does on a daily basis against Palestinians inside Israel in 1948 occupied territories. Now let's remember also that even the Israeli representative in the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, who is a right extreme minister, he used to be in charge of the Israeli internal policing and also on the prison authority, and he personally is involved in killing young Palestinians, and he dared to speak to the international community, and the UN is hosting basically a war criminal. Instead of arresting this criminal, they provide an international arena for him. These crimes, one of the reasons that it's especially the one that it's caught in videos, that's what people see. Sure. Very similar to what the U.S. police do on a daily basis against black youth, but we only see the one that is recorded on a video. But these crimes happen on a daily basis.
Sure. Well, let's break this down a little bit here, and let me ask you a direct question, Mazen Komsay, if I may. Noam Chomsky, I'm sure you've heard of him. Intellectual and philosopher, in a sense, he has said, without U.S. aid, Israel would not be killing, I'm quoting him, without U.S. aid, Israel would not be killing Palestinians en masse. What do you think?
Well, the U.S. government has mentioned Khaled is complicit. It's actually a partner in crime. I would go further to say that U.S. foreign policy and U.S. aid to Israel is guided, of course, by the Zionist lobby that's in Washington that pushes around the U.S., gets it involved in wars in the Middle East that cause trillions of dollars of taxpayers' money, and that's why the U.S. has a deficit and has a debt that's now reached over $23 trillion thanks to these endless wars. But the U.S. has been built basically on these wars, and in its history had only like 20 years of peace, when most of its history has been a history of either directly involved in war or supporting countries that regimes that engage in wars, like Saudi Arabia and Yemen, or Israel on Palestine. This is what they do. That's the nature of this U.S. regime, if I may use that word also, because that's what the nature of a colonial system is. And Israel is a daughter of the colonial system. It's a daughter of the British colonial system, and then taken over, basically adopted by the American colonial system. Mm. So it behaves in a very similar way in terms of its genocidal policies in these countries, in developing countries.
Well, I need to also have your take on this, if I may, Khaled Barakat, the U.S. support. We know the U.S. supports Israel, but it supports it in a way that it's almost unconditional. It's just there no matter what Israel is doing. How responsible do you think the U.S. is for Israel to feel this impunity?
Well, just like what Dr. Mazen Komsay said, I mean, Israel is basically an U.S. project today. Since 1956, when the United States entered the region, inherited the old colonial system of Britain and France, basically they inherited the area with Israel as well. I mean, we know that U.S. involvement in supporting the Zionist movement is long before 1956, but in that year, especially the Suez Canal crisis and the United States entering the region, with full force, and Israel became literally a U.S. project. Every crime Israel commits against the Palestinian people, the United States is responsible. Britain too are responsible, and we see that instead of apologizing and admitting their crimes against the Palestinian people of establishing this colonialist racist regime in Palestine, they are trying to criminalize the Palestinian resistance. We saw that in the U.S. We see this today in Britain. And this war against the Palestinian people and the resistance of the Palestinians is absolutely orchestrated in Washington and Tel Aviv. And I want to stress, on the issue of U.S. responsibility here, which means what the United States is also doing is trying to set an example that, crimes could be committed against Arabs in the region, not just Palestinians, but also in Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere, right, without going, punished or any kind of accountability.
All right. I was very taken aback, if I may ask you this, Muslim Kamsaya, about this critique that was leveled against the UN. And it came from a website by the name of UN Watch, which monitors UN actions against other entities and so forth. And it said, based on the findings, that the UN has condemned Israel in 3 resolutions. And this just happened in this, ruling that happened just days ago. Erases the Jewish connection to Judaism's holiest site, is how they worded it. And this is the December 1 report. The UN General Assembly, it said, adopted 3 resolutions targeting Israel. And it said it was part of a total of 14 resolutions being adopted over the next month that target it, with only 5 on the rest of the world. And very angry at why the UN is zooming in on Israel. Well, it's ironic that it would come out and say that it's being targeted for the violations that it's conducting. Then doesn't that put into a question why the UN cites all these illegal actions, but yet nothing happens? And then you have Israel that says, why are you picking on me?
Yes, I mean, since 1948, 100,000 Palestinians have been killed. Over 800,000, 900,000 have been injured. Over 1 million have been imprisoned. And every single human rights organization in the world and the United Nations Human Rights Commissions, various human rights resolutions in the UN, have all, every single one of them, even Israeli human rights organizations like B'Tselem, have reported these violations, and everybody knows these violations are happening, but Israel gets out basically with impunity for these things, as pointed out earlier. Now, why is that? Because Israeli colonial interests intersect strongly with American hegemonic interests in the Middle East. And this is also precisely why, and I'd like us to take a few moments to think about the not just the negative aspects of what's happening from the U.S. and Israel, but the positive aspects of what the local people are doing. That is precisely why resistance is growing around the world to these activities of the U.S. and Israel. It's the same situation as happened in South Africa under apartheid. It was a galvanizing movement around the world with boycott, divestment, sanctions, and other actions to target the regime of South Africa under apartheid. And the reason we did that with South Africa, and the reason we're now doing it with Palestine, because in both situations, this apartheid colonialist regime exposed the hypocrisy of Western world, exposed the hypocrisy of speaking about human rights for example, the Biden administration, while at the same time pumping billions of dollars to support the regimes that are devastating human rights around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, Khaled Barakat, can't mention or can't have this program not mention the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians there. Looking at the siege that began in the year 2007, 2021 is almost drawing to an end. It's almost unbelievable the way that they are surviving, if I can even use that word, survive, because that's what's happening there. And this is, again, under the watchful eye or unwatchful eye of the international community, seeing the way that this siege is affecting the lives there, from a lack of medicine, lack of food, to the, you name it, to all the difficulties there. Why is it that this particular situation is not paid attention to the way that it should and the way that it deserves?
Well, I mean, the siege is a war crime, and it goes against all international law and accords. Everyone knows that. This siege placed by Israel and the Egyptian regime together, and we see that, and the world sees that. But at the same time, Gaza is being targeted because in Gaza there is a strong Palestinian resistance. And what they want is the head of the resistance. They want the weapons of the resistance, and they want to break the will and the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza. When we talk about resistance in Gaza, we are talking about workers, fishers, farmers, teachers, not just military resistance. And so this popular Palestinian will that is confronting Israel, that is organizing for return to their homes in which they were displaced from, is met with besieging people, which is in a place, the largest prison in the world. Today, even Hamas have said publicly that the Egyptian regime is not meeting their responsibilities. I mean, when we talk about Egypt rule, and Israel is the enemy of the Palestinian people, but the Egyptian regime, this fascist regime led by Sisi and these generals, are also placing a heavy, measures against Palestinians in Gaza.
Sure. Well, in conclusion, I'd like to get your thoughts here, if I may, Mazen Kamzaya, on Israel's so-called normalization of ties under what the U.S. Put forward through its former president, Donald Trump. How much legitimacy did that give Israel, not only in terms of Israel itself, but also for it to continue its violations and for the, Arab countries to look the other way?
Well, the normalization activities with this Zionist colonization started at the beginning of the Zionist colonization. There was always Arab leaders, including even, sadly to say, Palestinian leaders, who think that the best way to deal with the situation is to accept the status quo and accept the hegemony of the Zionist project in Palestine. And I would go even further by saying that Israel would not have lasted one day without this normalization activities by the Arab regimes. Israel is not very strong. It's only made strong by, number one, Western support, which we talked about, and number two, by the normalization activities and basically collusion of some Arab leaders. Sad to say also, even the Palestinian Authority here in where I am now in the West Bank is colluding with this and supporting Israel through security coordination. And even just a few days ago or a week ago, there were some Israelis entered Ramallah, settlers, and they were protected by the Palestinian security forces. So unfortunately, this is the reality that the people have to face. And as pointed out earlier, there is the positive reality of resistance that's still happening in all its forms.
Okay, very well. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. It was great talking to you both, Palestinian journalist, writer, and activist Khaled Barakat. Thank you from Vancouver. And from Bethlehem, Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Kamzaya. Thank you for your comments. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. It was great having you on board. From Ikavetahwe, It's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
تبارك الذي نزل الفرقان على عبده ليكون للعالمين نذيرا
Blessed is he who sent down the criterion upon his servant that he may be to the world a warner.
Dear listeners, before we start talking about the first verse of this chapter, we'd better say that this surah is the 25th chapter, and it contains 77 verses, and it has been sent down in Mecca. In the first verses of this surah, the Quran has rendered it into Furqan, which means the separator of the right from wrong, and that is why this surah has been called Furqan. This surah consists of some verses about the pretexts of the pagans and, of course, the answers to them. This surah also talks about the lives of the former people, such as the people of Ras, and the people's regret in hereafter, the signs of unity, the greatness of Almighty Allah in nature, and the comparison of the believers with unbelievers. But it seems that the most important part of the verses of this holy surah is about the qualities of Ibadur Rahman, or those true servants of Allah, which begins from the 63rd verse to the end of the surah. We hope that by reciting these verses and by truly contemplating on them, we will see improvement in our behaviors and our manners based on these qualities, and we can pave the way of receiving the divine grace and favors in the world and hereafter, and finally, we enter paradise. There is a tradition quoted from Ishaq bin Ammar from Hadrat Abu al-Hasan, Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam, who told him, "Do not abandon reading and reciting surah, this Suratul Furqan, since if any believer reads it every night, he will not punish him at all, and he will not reckon him, and his abode will be in the exalted Firdaus." This has been narrated in Thawab al-A'mal by Saduq.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So let's just get started. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. The first verse states, Tabarakalladhi nazzala al-furqana ala 'abdihi liyakuna lil'alamina nadhira. Blessed is he who sent down the Furqan, the distinction of right and wrong, upon his servant, that he may be a warner to the world. This sentence introduces the Prophet Muhammad as the warner to the whole world. At first it starts saying, Tabaraka. This Quranic word is probable to have been derived from Baraka, which means abundant goodness. It is also possible that it is derived from the word in the sense of stable or fixed. So it implies that he who descended the Holy Quran is the source of many blessings, and one of his blessings, as an example, is this very descending of the Quran. And what blessing is more important than the divine law that has led billions of people from darkness to the light of guidance in the course of history? تبارك الذي نزل الفرقان. Blessed is he who sent down the Quran. If it is in the form of the word نزل, it means to send down gradually, and if it is in the form of the word أنزل, it means that sending down has happened immediately and at once. Well, of course, the Holy Quran has enjoyed both kinds of descending. One time is in the night of determination or honor, in which Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad at one instance, about which the Holy Quran says, "Inna anzallahu fi laylatil qadr." Surely we sent it down on the night of honor. And other time is done gradually during 23 years. Brothers and sisters, there are many points to be discussed regarding this first verse of the chapter, specifically about the true meaning of Furqan in this verse, and we will, God willing, talk about them in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Erubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thousands of Yemeni people have filled the streets and cities of Aden, Taiz and Mukalla in southern Yemen to protest against the government of former Saudi-backed President Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi. Protesters condemned the widespread poverty and the deterioration of public services within areas controlled by the Saudi-backed government.
We hold the Saudi-led coalition fully responsible for what the situation has reached, the spread of poverty and the decrease in the prices of the local currency. We are suffering to obtain flour and gas for our children.
We have a country that has oil and wealth, but unfortunately we are poor because of the corrupt government. They receive their money in dollars and Saudi riyals, and here salaries are worth nothing against foreign currencies and are not enough to provide a living.
Observers say the Saudi-backed Hadi regime has failed to maintain the local currency rate, even though it is not facing a siege or economic war like is happening in Sana'a. They say the departure of all the Saudi-led coalition forces is the only way to end the humanitarian crisis.
The living situation in the southern regions is bad, and the economic deterioration has reached a staggering level. And there are no attempts to stop this collapse by the Saudi-led coalition and its forces in the occupied areas. The free people there must demand the expulsion of the occupation, the cessation of printing the local currency without a cash cover, and the creation of economic alternatives that guarantee the Yemenis a decent life.
On March 2015, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been facing a tragic situation as the prices keep increasing due to the continued depreciation of the currency.
The economic situation in the occupied areas is getting day after day, causing a massive increase in the prices of food and other basic commodities. Observers say the situation is like a famine hitting these areas amid the continued silence of the international community.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbass and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation in all-out technology and trade blockade and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to this could be long-term security guarantees on its western borders. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Scores of disabled people and their families in the Gaza Strip came out to mark the International Day of Disabled Persons. They held a sit-in in front of the Ministry of Social Development to mark the annual international event. The Palestinian Non-Governmental Organizations Network, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting civilians, including people with disabilities, during the recent war on the Gaza Strip. Last May, Israeli regime forces killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children, during the wanton bombing of thousands of buildings in the blockaded enclave.
Tens of people became people with disability because of the Israeli offensive on the Gaza Strip. Also, four people with disability were killed in the last offensive. This year, we witnessed deterioration in the socio-economic conditions of people with disability because of the continuous illegal blockade imposed by Israel.
Currently, there are more than 50,000 disabled persons in the blockaded coastal enclave. Thousands of Palestinians in the impoverished territory became disabled during four Israeli wars since 2008. Scores more also suffered permanent disabilities during the 2018 Great March of Return peaceful rallies against Israeli occupation.
An Israeli sniper shot me while I was protesting peacefully during the Great March of Return in 2018 and I became disabled. I want the whole world to know that the Zionist regime is an illegitimate entity that occupies our land and doesn't understand the meaning of peace and only believe in violence and aggression.
During the last offensive, Israeli forces injured over 2,200 Palestinians, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability.
The world community is standing silent for the crimes of Israel. All the time they attack the children, women, and this even disabled people, hospitals, schools, But the problem that the international community is keeping silent, and there is no actions, no measure taken against Israel, and to impose sanction or repression on Israel to stop its aggression against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for disabled Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Experts say thousands of Palestinians in the besieged enclave have suffered from various disabilities in recent years due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons against the civilian population. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
After a long hunger strike that lasted for 131 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Kaid Al-Fasfus has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released Al-Fasfus from the Israeli hospital of Barzilai, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition because of his hunger strike. He arrived first at his hometown Doura village in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Then he headed to the grave of later President Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. He sent a message to the other prisoners to remain steadfast, reminding them that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
As I did it, my brothers who are on hunger strike will do it. It was not an easy experience at all. Me and the other prisoners went through difficult days and circumstances. We had been beaten, oppressed, and held in solitary confinement, and had been transferred frequently from one prison to another.
Israel arrested Al-Fasfus in October 2020, and it was not his first detention. He was arrested several times in the past, but this time he was held under administrative detention without charge or trial. Last month, the Israeli prison authorities decided to end his administrative detention and release him. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs has appraised Al-Fasfus' victory and appraised his encouragement, describing it as defeating the occupation's authorities, and it hoped that the remaining hunger-striking prisoners, on top of them Hisham Abu Hawash, who has been protesting for 111 days, would also achieve victory.
It's a victory for Al-Fasfus and for the prisoners' movement, as well as for all of us. We praise Al-Fasfus's stance. He refused to retreat despite his deteriorating health condition and bravely insisted on his demand.
Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner, as Israel holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners. Hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Kaid Al-Fasfus is free today after achieving a tremendous victory following 131 days of his hunger strike. His battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners held under Israel's administrative detention a glimmer of hope to go on with their actions and their fight for justice. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the Yellow Vest started their season two, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the eighth consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The Yellow Vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing.
Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the Yellow Vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations.
In Paris, one of the Yellow Vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media, and we pay to help privately owned media as well, but they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude and they both slander any dissenting voices. What we are asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected, and we are telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week, they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press during the age of Western corporate domination. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organizations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over. The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following a meeting with the signatories of the nuclear agreement, known as the JCPOA, Iran calls for a reasonable, documented and rational response to its proposals for the removal of US sanctions and Iran's return to full compliance. Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Boghari-Kani said Britain, France and Germany were not happy with some of Iran's proposals.
They had no complaint about these proposals being irrelevant, but they say they are not consistent with our viewpoints, and I told them this is natural. We are not supposed to express ideas that are in line with your viewpoints. We take our own interests and policies into consideration. The important point is that they are based on principles that all sides agree on. No European side claims that Iran's proposals lack legal basis.
A diplomatic source close to the Iranian negotiating team said the country's proposed drafts were in complete conformity with the JCPOA, adding it was regrettable that some European sides were attempting to dictate their own demands round the negotiating table while failing to acknowledge that a revival of the deal requires compliance by all sides.
I think the current administration, what it is saying is that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, good or bad, is something that Iran's accepted, and we will commit ourselves to it. However, we will not allow the other side to retain sanctions, maximum pressure sanctions, and then expect us to go back to 2015. That simply won't happen.
EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there were substantial challenges ahead, while time to reach an agreement was not unlimited. While Iran is calling for a rational and documented response to its proposals, European diplomats are expressing concern and scepticism. The Vienna talks are set to resume next week, when it may become more clear whether the gaps can be bridged. Homolezki, Vienna. The story of how Palestine was wrenched from the indigenous people lives on. It is passed down from chest to chest, from generation to generation. Even Palestinians born outside their homeland and raised in refugee camps or elsewhere carry the story with them. Attendees at this art exhibition say living in the UK, it's even more important to show up.
I think here in Britain, given Britain's role in creating the situation for Palestinian people and its ongoing support for the Israeli government and allowing it to carry out its apartheid policies, we have a special duty here to raise awareness about the situation, to fight our government when it supplies weapons to the Israeli government and gives it its support.
I support the struggle completely. And I love the forthright strength, the samud of the Palestinian people is inspiration to anybody. Anybody with any trouble, go to Palestine and see what trouble really is.
The elderly carry the keys to their demolished houses round their necks, and the new generation educate their children on the 1948 land grab that forced out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. This art exhibition in London is part of their ongoing struggle to raise the flag for Palestine.
I'm here today to celebrate our Palestinian culture, our amazing Palestinian artists. You know, our people are talented, clearly, and it's so nice to see them use their talents to preserve our culture.
This exhibition is called Visualizing Return. It launched on the anniversary of UN Resolution 194, which calls for the immediate return of all Palestinian refugees. Visualizing Return hopes to emphasize the necessity of granting Palestinian refugees this long overdue human right.
Interestingly enough, one of the easiest citizenships to acquire is Israeli citizenship. All you have to do is to prove that you have a Jewish grandparent or a Jewish spouse. But there is a Palestinian diaspora 6 million strong, and they are not allowed to return to their homeland.
The Israeli regime wants to maintain a Jewish majority. If the diaspora were allowed to return, they would by far outnumber the Jewish population. So 73 years into occupation, the demographic war rages on. Exiled Palestinians are raising awareness, but on the front line of this struggle are the men, women and children holed up in the largest open-air prison in the world, the Gaza Strip. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In its latest annual report, Italy's Center for Social Studies and Policies, CENSIS, has found that some 2 million Italian families were in absolute poverty in 2020, a rise of more than 100% on 2010. This is due to the outbreak of COVID-19 that has accentuated a sense of vulnerability in the country. CENSIS report shows that over 40% of Italians feel insecure, while students suffer increasing levels of depression, anxiety, and existential angst.
The COVID-19 pandemic has made more workers vulnerable to pay discrimination, loss of income, and exploitative practices. The socioeconomic malaise, which was already worrying before the pandemic, is today very much widespread to all layers of the population.
The company we work for refuses to meet us to discuss the terms of our contract as the pandemic is completely changing the way we work. This is unacceptable.
Over the past months, hundreds of large and smaller protests have been staged across Italy with workers from both the public and private sectors expressing deep concern over their deteriorating rights situation. On Friday in Rome, employees from Sogei, the information and communication technology company of the Ministry of the Economy and Finance, held a demonstration demanding to negotiate new smart working guidelines with the employer. Also on Friday, farmers from an area north of Naples staged a protest near the Agriculture Ministry calling the government for financial assistance. Hundreds of small farming companies have gone bankrupt as the large-scale retail trade has preempted small entrepreneurs.
We haven't been allowed to be here in big numbers due to the COVID restrictions. The government must help us. We are asked to observe the most stringent food regulations when it comes to our products, but fruit and vegetables full of pesticides coming from Morocco and other countries are let in without controls. Furthermore, we haven't received a penny from the EU aid funds to farmers. When the money lands into the regional government's account, it simply disappears.
On Friday, Rome and Milan were both affected by a public transport four-hour strike called by the General Union of Labour, UGL. The nationwide action was called by unionists against the obligation for workers to have the Green Pass, a certificate proving the holder has been vaccinated, tested negative, or recovered from COVID-19. Max Civili, Rome.